So this is our final talk. So this Buddha field, in a way, has been a really positive celebration, and it's been a celebration of the three jewels over the last 3 days as well. When I was trying to think about the theme for this gathering, I was talking to Padma Vajra, and he was helping me a little bit, and he said that he, because he's been here and given talks before, and he said he felt that the summer gathering was really important for not only for our Buddhist movement but for the world, because it's an environment where we can come together and celebrate as human beings in a really positive way. Often, you know, there's other ways we celebrate in the world, or other people might, that might involve a lot of drinking and, you know, drugs. So, coming together is a really healthy human need to come together, celebrate, sing, dance, share. So definitely feels like that's happened in this Buddha field. So well done, everyone. So this is Amalekhetu.
Yay!
So there's been another thing happening with the talks of this event. They were quite, there was quite a few gaps in the people that had offered to do talks. So I just feel really fortunate that my friends have just stepped up and stepped in to take this on. Some of them at quite a short notice. And I guess, so the theme of the overall gathering is a force for good in the world. And so us order members, when we get ordained, in a way that's what we've signed up for. We've signed up for being a force for good in the world. And I think a main part of that practice is you just kind of say, yes, like I'm looking at Ariadara, he's come and helped cook. He cooks in his normal life, I think, do you? Yeah, and it's probably the last thing you want to come and do. But he's just responded to a request to come and help this really positive event happen. So Amalekhetu especially, his name in a way means a force for good in the world. So it's great that he's giving this Sangha dual day talk. So Amala means pure and Ketu means comet. So anyone that knows Amalekhetu will know that that is just the right name, yeah, for him. He's been ordained for nearly six years. He's the chairman of the Colchester Buddhist Centre for the last 2 years. And he just amazes me, actually. He's just got this energy. He also doesn't have always great health. And he just has this capacity to just keep being a force for good in the world. And I never see him sort of flapping, not like me. You know, he just kind of just does so many things and holds so many classes and responds to people, and he's really interested in men. Well, and women. He's really interested in building Sangha. And he puts a lot of energy into the men's group and men's events, you know, brings people to Padmaloka, gets people to go on retreat. He's just a real force for good in the world. He really wants you to grow. So it's an absolute delight having Amalekhetu here giving this talk for our Sangha Dual Day. So thank you very much for stepping up.
Okay, thank you, Sangha Mani. Okay, I'll start with a quote. It is possible that the next Buddha will not take the form of an individual. The next Buddha may take the form of a community practicing understanding and loving kindness, a community practicing mindful living. This may be the most important thing we can do for the survival of the earth. And that was a quote by Thich Nhat Hanh, who's obviously a Buddhist. Just in case you know. So I'd just like to start by thanking all my friends in the Sangha, and especially helping me when the going gets tough, because it does. It does. And also a special thanks to Karen Adi for helping me rewrite this talk from scratch on the basis my original Earthkind Day talk which although was actually very good, wasn't actually what this day was about. So thanks for that. Sleep is for losers. So we're here today in a Buddha field, in case you didn't realise. What is a Buddha field? So the concept of a Buddha field originates in Mahayana Buddhist sutras, texts which were written sometime after the Buddha's death. And a Buddha field is a plane of perfect beauty created by the compassionate action of a Buddha. They are an environment, then, that the conditions are perfect for spiritual practice and to achieve enlightenment. Of course, it's also a place where we can stand around with a banjo singing in the field, making shadow puppets of Batman and Robin, sit around the campfire discussing chickens, and where grown men run around in green leotards. But essentially, it is a place where we can practice together as a spiritual community, as a Sangha, and what a beautiful place it is. Importantly, though, a Buddha field cannot, as Lokabandhu mentioned in his talk, operate without people, without us, the ones who are doing the practicing. We are the ones who fall under the influence of the Buddha, and our Buddha of this world system at this time, because there are other Buddhas in other world systems, and some world systems have multiple Buddhas, and some world systems, unfortunately, do not have any Buddhas. Mm. We are fortunate. We have our own Buddha from 2,500 years ago, Shakyamuni, Gautama the Buddha, and he lived in northeast India 2,500 years ago, which has been brought more to life here, being here. So hopefully you've got a taste from Kamanadi's talk and the rituals. You've got a sense of the Buddha. So there's no one account of the Buddha, as it were, in terms of physical description. So in order to kind of get a gauge of who he was, what he looks like, you'd have to pull from different sutras, different commentaries. So I've kind of got one here. So he was shaven-headed, well-built, of normal height and strikingly handsome, of golden-coloured skin, although probably it's more likely his skin would be quite tan from sitting in the sun of India. And apparently Gautama had grace, elegance and decorum. And apparently, this is quite fascinating actually, impeccable table manners. Quite a lot of us, I think. So with that picture in mind of the Buddha, maybe not eating like this, but, you know, walking around India. With that picture in mind, let's go back in time together 2,500 years ago. And I've been dying to do this for ages. So we're now back in northeast India 2,500 years ago. We are. So we're picking up on Dharmacharan's talk of yesterday. So we've already had the Buddha gain enlightenment. And he's walked, he's met a few people who haven't got a clue who he is. And finally he arrives in Sarnath, up about 100 miles away from Bodh Gaya, where he got enlightened. And he goes to where his friends, the five ascetics who he'd been practicing with before his enlightenment, are hanging out. Yeah, and he thinks to himself, maybe these five could understand the Dharma, yeah? Maybe they could understand. Maybe they could realize the same vision as I had. So he goes over and he sees Ashwajit, Badia, Mahamanama, Vashya and Kandanya. And they're all hanging around and they sit there and they're sitting there and then they see the Buddha approaching and then they start thinking, there he is, Gautama, the guy, he didn't quite take the heat, he couldn't handle it. Let's ignore him, yeah. You know, you can kind of come down and say, let's just ignore somebody. When they come, yeah, let's just ignore him. But as he approaches, the glow and the eminence of this man coming towards him, they kind of can't help themselves but to kind of lay a seat for him, bring him water, wash his feet, and make him comfortable. So he sits down, and the Buddha speaks, maybe, and he says, listen, the deathless has been achieved. I will give instruction. I will teach the truth. If you practice as instructed, you soon will come to live, having experienced and attained here and now for yourselves through direct knowledge the ultimate goal of the spiritual life. So the five ascetics are a bit blown away by that. But they're not sure. They're not 100% sure, yeah? The Buddha's insisting he has awoken, he has finally awakened. And they, you know, they can't quite go with it. But he says, you know, have I ever spoken like this before? And they're like, no, no, you haven't. So he says, you know, this is it, you know, this is it. So he just talks of the Dharma. He talks of the path he discovers. And he reveals it, in effect, for the first time. And it's said in the Dharmachakra Pavasana Sutta, where this comes from, that the ascetics delighted in his words. And while this explanation was being given, there arose in Venerable Kondanya the dustless, stainless Dharma eye. Whatever is subject to origination is subject to cessation. And when the Blessed One had set the wheel of the Dharma in motion, the earth devas cried out, at Varanasi, at the deer park at Ishvastana, the Blessed One has set in motion the unexcelled wheel of the Dharma that cannot be stopped by Brahmin or contemplative, Deva, Mara or God or anyone in the cosmos. Then the Blessed One explained, so you really know, Kondanya, so you really know. And that is how Kondanya acquired the name Anna Kondanya, Kondanya who knows. And the Buddha realized, at that point, the Buddha realized the Dharma could be communicated. And soon after, the other four ascetics also gained enlightenment. And this marked the beginning of the Sangha. There were six enlightened beings in the world. So coming back to 1997. I love that. I want to do that in all my talks now. So it's 15 years ago. My experience of the Sangha, in fact. So 15 years ago, I came through the doors of what was then the Colchester Buddhist Group in Oxford Road in Life Force. Some of us know that. And I found actually there what my spiritual life had been missing. So I've been practicing meditation. I kind of learnt it from books. And I've been pretty much on my own. In actual fact, I was doing all sorts of weird and wonderful things, in fact. But I didn't really have a benchmark or anything. And I didn't really know what I was doing, if I'm totally honest. And I certainly didn't know any group of individuals that were practicing together. And I was doing my own thing with no feedback and not in connection with anybody else. But then when I came through the door and I was welcomed in and I was taught the metta bhavana practice, as some of you may have been taught in this gathering. And then also to an aspect of Buddhist teaching, I felt challenged, inspired, invigorated. And I knew then that I found what I was looking for. It was friendship, a spiritual community, and what I didn't know the name for, but of course we probably all know that name now, the Sangha and the Sanghajal, which we're celebrating today. And that Sanghajal has helped me personally grow and develop. I was brought along by two very good friends of mine, Harshaprabha and Amoka Vajra, some of you obviously know, from Ipswich at the moment. And I didn't know then, but I don't know, that they had such a significant effect on my life. They became my spiritual friends, and we have a ceremony to mark that, Kalyana Mitrata, beautiful friendship, and we had a celebration of that. And we lived together in community, relatively harmoniously, perhaps not quite as harmoniously as the Anuruddhas, who I'm going to introduce you to a bit later on. But we did form a small community in Colchester. So I've lived in community before. I've lived in a community on a kibbutz in Israel for about 4 years, in fact. And it's a great place to be. Very wonderful, but there's no spiritual substance. In fact, everyone was getting commune, as fact, things were distributed evenly. But I was working with a guy, my boss, and he was saying to me, well, why should the laundry lady who does 2 hours a day get the same as me, the site manager who does all this work in engineering? Yeah, and this ultimately led to the complete downfall of that kibbutz, in fact, and it was the end of that kibbutz. So in our own small community in Colchester, we did have spiritual vitality, and of course we have here today. We meditated together, we discussed issues, we had friends over from the Buddhist Centre for dinner, we watched a few trashy DVDs too, but we were living as a Buddhist community, and it helped my commitment deepen, and it helped me through my early days becoming a Mitra, and it, actually I was living there in that community right through to my ordination in 2006. Yeah. So my friendships have developed and deepened more and more, and I'm in good connection with Sangha members from all over the world, in fact. And I have many beautiful friends in the spiritual life, and I do consider myself very fortunate. So the Sangha, or the Arya Sangha, as it's usually known in more traditional forms of Buddhism, is the group or community of spiritually developed individuals, helping us to develop our individuality and our potential for the ideal of human enlightenment. So it's not a group of friends as such, but responsible members of the spiritual community. And actually, these members are enlightened, the Arya Sangha, actually, or certainly close enough to it. And these most excellent beings are known as true individuals. So I'm going to explain a little bit what a true individual is, because they do make up that Sangha. So in my experience, although we're all aspiring to a degree or other to be a group of spiritually developed individuals, we're probably not enlightened or stream entrants. Those that have entered the spiritual stream and are destined for enlightenment, they say within 7 lifetimes, although I could be mistaken and I'm the only one sitting here unenlightened and everybody else here is enlightened, which is possible, and you're kind of humouring me. So what is a true individual then? Who is it we're aspiring to become? So Sangha Achyuta, the founder of this community, this Sangha, defines a true individual as someone who's broken free from group conditioning. So breaking conditioning is not easy. We may not even be aware we're conditioned at all, in fact, until we can step out of those conditions which create our conditioning. So there's a little story I'd like to share which kind of touches on this. So a man dies. That's how it starts, the man dies. So it's like the end, but it's the beginning. So he dies, and he wakes up, and he's in a beautiful white mansion, and there's a beautiful long white dining room, and he suddenly appears from the death state, and he's there, and he's sort of dressed up in a little bow tie and stuff, and he thinks, wow, gosh, I must be in heaven. So he's sitting there. And a waiter comes through, and he says, hello, sir, you know. He said, what would you like? And he says, the menu. And he says, well, you can have anything you want. So he says, okay, I'll have this, I'll have this, I'll have that. Finish off a glass of wine. And then he comes back through and he says, would you like to watch a film? Anything you want. Okay, Gladiator was my favourite film in life. I watched that. So he sits down and watches film. Anyway. Getting for it. The next day, the same thing happens. So what would you like for breakfast? Anything you want. What would you like for lunch? Massage? Yeah, fine, sit down. Anyway, he's great. Anyway, this goes on and on and on and on. And then he thought, God, I haven't really got any challenges. There's nothing really for me to do. He's getting a bit bored, actually. So he thinks, well, actually, I'd quite like to do something here and, yeah, be involved, do something. So he sort of, the waiter comes in, so you rang? And he says, well, yeah, I'd like to do some work. He says, well, I'm sorry, you can't do that here. He says, what? He says, I thought I could have anything I wanted. He says, well, work is forbidden. He says, well, that doesn't seem like heaven, this seems like hell. He goes, well, where do you think you are? It's not a Jewish joke. So how do we see beyond our conditioning? How can we see where we're at and that we are even conditioned and that we are imprisoned, in fact? How do we see that we are actually in prison? And I'm not going to go into that now because it's too much to say on that, but perhaps I thought we could perhaps go through that in our little groups, actually, about our group conditioning, yeah? So, I just want to say a little bit more about why we need a Sangha, yeah? Why do we need a Sangha? Because, you know, hey, we've got the teachings, we know a little bit about Buddhism, let's just crack on in our own kind of world, yeah? So I'm actually going to read from the Udana, actually, with a few slight changes of my own. But essentially from the Udana. Thus have I heard. Once the Buddha was staying at Kalika on Kalika Hill. Now on that occasion, the Venerable Magia was in attendance of the Buddha. The Venerable Magia came to the Buddha, saluted him, stood at one side and said to the Exalted One, I desire, sir, to go to the Jantu village for alms food. And the Buddha sits and he says, do whatever you think it is time for, Magia. Good response. That wasn't in the Udana, sorry. So the Venerable Magia, raising himself and taking his bowl and robe, goes to Jantu village. And he goes and gets his arms round. And on the way back, he spies over the top a beautiful mango grove. And he kind of clocks it. And he goes back to the Buddha. That wasn't in the Udana. And he says, wow. Buddha, he says, if you'll give me leave, I would love to go and meditate in that beautiful mango grove. And the Buddha says, wait a little, Magia, I'm alone. So the Buddha, when he was being waited on, he likes to kind of have an attendant with him. But Magia kind of insists, well, you know, please, you know, it is a kind of nice place. I really think I could get somewhere here. You know, you've kind of done it all, and I've got it all to do. Can I go to the mango garden? And the Buddha says, just wait a little, Magia. But once more, Magia says, look, I really feel this is the right time for me. This is my moment. So the Buddha just simply says, do what you think it is time for, Magia. So, of course, the Magia goes off, very excited, no doubt. Goes into the mango grove, sits down, finds a nice mango tree, sits down on the tree, and sits there. And all of a sudden, lustful thoughts arise, harmful thoughts, malicious thoughts. Magia just can't get it. He goes, this is very strange. I went forth from the home to the homeless life full of faith, and now I'm assailed by these violent, vicious thoughts. What is going on? So he goes back to the Buddha and he says, this is not working. What is going on? And the Buddha replied, Magia, when the heart's release is immature, five things lead to the maturity. What are these five? So firstly, they need spiritual friends, good associates, and they need the companionship of good people. And when the heart's release is immature, Magia, this is the first thing that leads to their maturity. Secondly, they should be virtuous, practicing ethical behavior, seeing danger even in small faults and training themselves in the precepts. Thirdly, they should be surrounded by talk that is serious and open to the heart, that conduces to detachment, to dispassion, to calm, to understanding, to insight, to nirvana. They should be firm and energetic, abandoning what is unskillful and requiring what is skillful. They should be stout and strong in effort, not laying aside the burden of pursuing what is unskillful. So finally, Magia, a monk should have insight. He should be endowed with the penetrating insight that sees all things rise and fall and leads to the end of suffering. And when the heart's release is immature, Magia, that is the fifth thing. So when, Magia, you have spiritual friendship, you will be virtuous. You will keep your vows. You will practice ethical behavior. You will see danger even in the smallest faults. When you have spiritual friendship, you will be firm and energetic, and you will abandon what is unskillful and acquire what is skillful. And when you have spiritual friendship, you can be expected to develop the penetrating insight that leads to the end of suffering. So we see from that sutra that spiritual friendship, the basis of the Sangha, is what is needed to mature our hearts, to release our hearts, to gain liberation. So when I came through the Buddhist Center in Colchester, I was very enthusiastic about gaining enlightenment, but I had actually no idea how to get there or what it was. So I'm not saying right now I do know exactly what it is or how to get there, but I think I've got a much better idea. And I feel it's not enough just to have the two of jewels, you know, the Buddha jewel and the Dharma jewel. It's not the complete picture. We need spiritual friends and we need community, the love of our brothers and sisters in the Dharma. So our practice of ethics, speech, energy and insight are all brought fully to life through interaction with the Sangha. And let's face it, we all have blind spots. So we can work through this with our spiritual friends and work towards enlightenment together. And then hopefully when we're all enlightened and we can take it out into the world, making it a world of peace and beauty and love, then we can have the grooviest ever enlightened party. What else would there be to do? A party. So our tree rat in the community is rather unique in the Buddhist world, as far as I know, because of the emphasis it places on spiritual friendship. And since I've been coming along, I've heard this story many times. I'm sure lots of you will know this story. But we can never tire of old truths. I think that is how the saying goes. I sometimes get sayings really wrong. But it tells the importance of spiritual life and friendship in spiritual life. So in the last 25 years of the Buddha's life, obviously Magia gets booted off because he was hopeless attendant. He's got Ananda with him, his cousin. Or Magia keeps on going off to the mango grove, you know. So an Ananda comes along. Does anybody know what happened to Magia? No. We're going to come back to him. Ananda was the Buddha's personal attendant. So he approaches the Buddha, an intent on sharing a thought, something, perhaps the cumulative effect of day-to-day association with the Buddha, has suddenly made him realize something. And he realizes that spiritual life, spiritual friendship is far more crucial to spiritual progress than he had imagined. So he enthusiastically declares, Lord, this spiritual friendship, this spiritual companionship and spiritual intimacy is no less than half of the spiritual life. And he looks kind of chuffed with himself at this great realization. And the Buddha just turns again and he says to Ananda, "Say not so, Ananda, say not so. It is the whole, not the half of the spiritual life." So for me, the whole of the spiritual life points to that which is beyond even the goal. It is goalless, if you like. Practicing friendship for its own sake. Before enlightenment, practice friendship. After enlightenment, practice friendship. That's all there is to do. So let's just do this. Be a friend for no other reason than itself. And this is the essence of the Sangha. Spiritual friendship with one another for no other sake than friendship's sake. Being part of the Sangha, nourishing it, helping it to grow. So treasure your friends in the Sangha. And I know it's not always easy. And dare I say it, we sometimes can grate on each other's nerves, yeah. Especially in the field, you know. People have strained idiosyncrasies. They do kind of weird things. We don't kind of like that, yeah. But we all have them. Maybe, yeah. but we can practice metta with one another, being kind, generous, and being wholehearted in our practice of friendship. It's so rewarding. It really is the whole of the spiritual life. So I want to draw on the vision. It's a beautiful vision of friendship, actually, of three friends living together. It's a sutta with Aniruddha and his friends, and they're living together alone, yeah? So Aniruddha, Nandi and Kimbala are staying together in a quiet forest grove, and the Buddha goes to visit them one evening after emerging from solitary meditation. And so becoming aware of the teacher's arrival, the three monks hasten to welcome him, one relieving him of his bowl and his outer robe, another making his seat ready, and the third bringing water to bathe his feet. And when they're all seated, the Buddha first checks they're in good health, as you do in India, always check, and making sure they've got enough food. And then he asks them about, you know, what's it like? How's it going? Do they get on well with each other? So Aniruddha confirms that he and the other two are living in accord, with mutual appreciation, without disputing, blending like milk and water, and viewing each other with kindly eyes. And the Buddha, who knows that actually not all monks get along so well, inquires how they manage to do so. So Aniruddha explains that he considers himself fortunate enough to be living the spiritual life with such great companions as Nandi and Kimbala. To do this, is, in his opinion, is a great gain for him. The way they live together is an expression of metta. Accordingly, he maintains a positive attitude towards the other two in every possible way, kindly deeds, affectionate speech, and loving thoughts. Aniruddha's words suggest that he's been developing metta towards his companions as a practice, something nurtured through mindfulness, a conscious part of the spiritual life. However, what began as a practice now became second nature. He's reached the point of routinely putting the other's desires before his own. He simply asks himself, why should I not have set aside what I wish to do and do what others wish to do? Yeah. And then he does precisely that. In conclusion, he tells the Buddha, we are different in body, Venerable Sir, but one in mind. Nandi and Kimbala, for their part, reply to the Buddha in the same way, each saying he has surrendered his own inclinations and is living according to the will of the other two. They all agree they are different in body but one in mind. And as they have given up their wills to each other, there is no question of one dominating the other two. It seems they experienced a shared will, or rather a mysterious coincidence of wills, perhaps, based on a deep mutual awareness and harmony. And the Buddha expresses his approval of the three friends' way of life and inquires, what spiritual fruits have you attained? So, replying, Aniruddha replies on behalf, saying, they've all three of them have passed through the whole range of spiritual and transcendental attainments. In other words, they're all enlightened. And the Buddha is delighted by wonderful news. Not wonderful news, yeah. Better than some of the news we read today, isn't it? Eventually, after some further talk, he leaves them. So the Buddha goes off. At that point, Nandi and Kimbala have a question for Aniruddha. So one gets the impression they don't actually talk that much, but they ask, have we ever told you that we've achieved such supernatural states? Have we ever said to you? He says, no, you never have. But I could speak confidently, and I know your spiritual attainments. And he knew where the others were at, and they all knew where each other was at, yeah? So this expression, one in mind, was not just a figure of speech, but more literally true, perhaps, than we might have guessed. So this story of three friends shows that spiritual friendships suggests there's a kind of ascending spiral in which a life lived in friendship leads upwards to spiritual realization, which in turn bears the fruit of deeper friendship and communication. So I'd encourage you, unlike Megia, to get along to your local Buddhist center or get on retreat and maintain your contact with the Sangha. I know we feel very busy in our lives, or we always got lots to do in our daily lives, but we must make priority, in my opinion, to get in contact, to maintain contact with each other, yeah? And there's a saying Martin Luther's apparently said when he's asked of his plans for his day, and he says, "My plan for the next day is work, work, from early until late. In fact, I have so much to do that I will spend at least 3 hours in prayer." So perhaps we could approach our meditation with the same vigour. So one of the lovely and magnificent things I love about Buddhafield is coming back here year after year to the gathering, as I do. I see the same people coming back, yeah? And I know, actually, these people are practicing, yeah? When I'm not there, you know, there's practice going on, yeah? Because actually, they probably wouldn't be here, yeah? And each year, you know, people look brighter and happier, yeah? Yeah, so Daniel over there looking bright and happy. And, and people, you know, coming back, I know they're practicing, I know they're in their own. Billy says to me the reason he came back the second year was because of the people, yeah? And, and that's a joyful thing to hear, you know, that's why people are coming back. And of course, I regularly see people from my dear Colchester Sangha who are here today as well. And I know that those that don't maintain their practice, they kind of end up falling back into the quagmire of samsara, actually. I was wondering if we could maybe put a poster up and it says, "Where are they now?" And other pictures, and you can sort of see them in the world. So, enlightenment cannot truly occur on an individual basis. Practicing for oneself alone, and only by practicing for and with others, can we know what is known as the bodhicitta to arise. So the bodhicitta is the heart mind of enlightenment, the will to enlightenment for the sake of all beings. And the Sangha creates this context for us to practice for the bodhicitta to arise. So we can think in terms of living together as Aniruddha and his friends, living in concord with mutual appreciation, without disputing, blending like milk and water, and viewing each other with kindly eyes. And in these difficult times, with all our economic, social and environmental issues of today, this is what the world needs more than ever. These issues, you know, are not going to be solved at their own level. They need a spiritual response, I firmly believe. And that spiritual response is creative, not reactive, as Dharmacharya says, yeah? And this is what the Sangha, I believe, can offer to the world. And as the quote I began with suggests, the next Buddha may not take the form of an individual at all, but a community. And we can be part of that community, part of that Sangha. So we, by participating in our own practice, we're contributing to the whole, creating a Buddha field. And like the words of the threefold puja that we've practiced, the stick of incense, which represents the perfect life, sweeter than incense, spreads in all directions throughout the world. Thanks.
So the final jewel of our three jewels talks been given, and hopefully that will permeate our experience and we'll be taking that out into the world.